Michael Kramer of New York Magazine has called it the wimp factor.
You know Michael Kramer?
Yes.
He'll never play linebacker for the Chicago Bears. You ever seen him?
George will.
He'll never play linebacker for the Chicago Bears either. You ever seen him?
George will has said, the silly, unpleasant sound Bush is emitting as he traipses from one conservative gathering to another is a thin, tinny arf, the sound of a lapdog.
Mm-hmm.
Anything you want to say to George will?
Just that he'll never play linebacker for the Chicago Bears. Have you ever seen him? I'll put my record out there with anybody. You know that I was shot down when 2 months after my 20th birthday fighting for my country? I didn't detect any wimp factor there. Do you know that we had to sit, my wife and I, and watch a child wrenched from our hearts in 6 months of cancer, knowing she was going to die? Little strength comes from that. Do you know that I've run agencies like the CIA and restored the morale out there by making tough decisions, moving people around, not jumping out trying to get credit? But if his complaint is that I'm loyal to this president, guilty as charged.
Hello, everybody. It's Wednesday, March 27th, and Felix and I are joined today by our good friend Michael Judge of the Death is Just Around the Corner podcast. And Michael is going to be helping us sort of extend the Poppy series into George H.W. Bush's tenure as director of the CIA, his involvement in what's known as the Iran-Contra affair, and even some connections with the octopus murders that we discussed with Noah Colwyn and the filmmakers behind the new Netflix documentary. So basically, we didn't get to live in this spectacular Fourth Reich just by accident. It took the hard work of a lot of dedicated people like Poppy. And to understand the evil that we live in today, we have to go back and do some research on the evil of the past, which, you know, Michael is very adept at doing. So let me just, without further ado, welcome Michael Judge of Death is Just Around the Corner to the show.
Hey, guys, thank you very much. Wanted to do this for a long time. And I'll tell you, I was doing pretty well today until just before I got on this call. Apparently there's something going on in Gaza.
Oh, yeah. You're not going to believe. You're not going to believe what Israel's been up to.
Ooh, wow, that looks rough.
Yeah, more bad news, though. It's not just, people aren't just suffering in Gaza. They're suffering in Connecticut right now. And mm-hmm. I'm sorry if I get a little emotional during this, but right before we started recording today, news broke that former U.S. Senator and vice presidential candidate Joe Lieberman has died.
People, check your Molly before you do it. That's all we can say.
Well, Felix, I was wondering, I didn't even know he was sick. He was just in the news last week scolding Chuck Schumer for being mean to Netanyahu. Then it turns out he died because of, quote, complications relating to a fall, which I think is a really supremely ironic way for someone who is, like, against video game violence in the Senate to die from taking fall damage.
No, he didn't get the cat ring from Dark Souls 2. You have to be a really shitty old person to die from a fall. Old people fall all the fucking time. My grandmother's 104, and the only way she, like, gets from one place to another is basically through a series of falls. And she just keeps getting stronger. If you die, you know, as an old person from falling, either, you know, you got murdered for your Wurlitzer that your grandkids are going to sell, or you're just like, you weren't cut out for being old.
Yeah.
Not everybody is, you know?
Yeah.
I will note that Joe Biden is only 1 year older than Joe Lieberman, a guy who just got obliterated by losing his balance for half a second.
Yeah. But like, look how much Joe Biden, another guy who like gets from point A to point B by falling.
It's true.
And
it's
he just gets right back up.
He's a lot hardier. Or at least he has the cat ring. That's one of the amulets of protection that they give him every time he leaves the White House.
Yeah, Delaware is Dark Souls 2. Just like a horrifying blend of environs that don't make sense. Time is convoluted. I will always remember Joe Lieberman. You know, anyone who was on the liberal internet in the early to mid 2000s, of course, remembers the dawn of democracy, the era of Ned Lamont. But I will always remember him for, you know, when he like he made his wife be more Jewish, when he was like, okay, your name's Hadassah now. And she was like, okay.
It's one of the bravest things you can do. That's the David Brooks move.
Yeah, getting your wife to change her first name. That's real pimping. That's not perpetrator pimping. That's real pimping.
Hadassah is crazy. Like, he wasn't just like it's crazy enough to like tell a like 50-year-old woman, okay, your name has to be like Rachel or Sarah or something. But like Hadassah, that's like a girl that King David fucked.
getting with their wives' handmaidens, getting into the Hebrew vino.
I got a bitch called Bathsheba.
I was trying to think back to like some of Joe Lieberman's highlights over his career, and outside of being a huge supporter of the war in Iraq and Israel, of course, the things that came to mind was like the violence in video games hearings, and then I remembered, despite being on. Like, remembered mostly for being a hawk and for like many of America's worst wars and Israel's worst crimes. He is also one of the main reasons we don't have a public option for Medicare. Like any even slight expansion of Medicare or the lowering of the age limit for Medicare, he was been like basically solely responsible for killing. So, I mean, he's done so much good for the world. I hope he meets he's in a more appropriate place now, is what I'm saying.
I will never forget that fucking Howard Dean Twitter thread from like 2017, where he basically said, oh yeah, we had all the votes for universal healthcare, but in order to get it through, we would have had to strip Joe Lieberman of like his committee privileges.
And no. Obviously
you don't do that to a guy.
You do not do that to a man like Joe Lieberman. I guess I'd like to know more about the fall. Was it a staircase situation? You know, that's usually what happens here. Sort of like someone left a roller skate outside his bedroom. Was it a hilarious sort of Looney Tunes style accident? I don't know. But speaking of accidents, the other big news from this week was the rather spectacular collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore. Fellas, PSYOP or not PSYOP?
God, I was so fucking mad that this stupid bullshit happened. Like it used to be on 2014, basically 2014 to 2018, let's say, whenever there was a mass shooting, that's when you would see the worst fucking posts ever. You know, it was just like a bunch of late night writers being like, if you want to kill 38 people in a classroom, how about try being fucking nice to people? And it's like, all right, yeah, whatever future mass killer is following Andy Richter, please, you know, pay attention to that. Just bullshit. But now, because of the cultural shift on Twitter, now it's just when anything happens.
Yeah.
It's just anything.
Good or bad. Any good or bad event that happens.
It's all a PSYOP. Don't ask me what that means. Don't ask me, you know, who benefits. They're just throwing shit out there in the wind. I love the people who are like, this is, you know, infrastructure is so bad because we either gave too much money to black guys or Ukraine. And it's like
that bridge has probably been collapsing for 50 years now.
That bridge was built in 1972. What fucking bridge can withstand the heaviest civilian vessel known to man? Like, the only thing that's like heavier and can move is probably like a Nimitz class aircraft carrier. And those have to be powered by nuclear reactors.
Nothing can withstand
that.
They were like, bridges don't just collapse when like the world's largest ship plows into one of their supports. Like, I was like, no, it's like, it's pretty obvious what happened. And like, the idea that like this was some sort of like cyber attack or whatever, I don't know, maybe, but like, to me, the more believable explanation is that like this shit probably comes about 1 centimeter away from happening probably every day in this country.
Yeah. I mean, this being the place it happened too, I don't have a lot of evidence for this so far, but my theory at this point is this was a Ravens Ronnie op. This was raised.
To sever Dundalk from the rest of Maryland. Exactly. like the Gaza Strip.
This was Ronnie saying, yeah, if we can't have the fucking Super Bowl, we can't have nothing. Get the fuck out of here. We don't want you.
Yeah. And I guess it's not just new frontiers in conspiracy theories. The bridge collapse also opened up some new frontiers in racism, which I've also been enjoying, because I just love the phrase the DEI mayor of Baltimore, because Baltimore has a black guy who's mayor. It's like the DEI mayor of Baltimore would be a white guy. Like, this is Baltimore. What do you like? Tommy Carchetti was the diversity, equity, and Martin O'Malley was the inclusion mayor of Baltimore.
Yeah, it would be Ronnie.
Yeah.
Like, I saw the video of the mayor of Baltimore talking about this after, and it was just like the most like normal mayor shit that you say after a bridge explodes. He was like, yeah, we're working with like federal and state, and you know, we're praying for everybody. And then all the right wing like posts I've seen after are like, oh, did you hear him? He was like, oh, we be repairing that bridge. It's like, that's, yeah, like you can see video. That's like not what he sounds like.
we're gonna rebuild that bridge, but only people who are not white can use it. I think that's fair. I think that's fair.
Yeah. So yeah, I think things in I hope they rebuild the bridge. Love to Baltimore. Let's not sever Dundalk from the rest of Maryland. Let's it should be open. There should be free travel. You should not have to show a passport or anything to leave Dundalk. But who knows? Qui bono, we ask in these situations. And I guess the last thing I want to mention before we get into George Poppy Bush's tenure at the CIA is, I just gotta say, I did read that hilarious Atlantic cover story about a campus culture war at Stanford. And I'm just going to say I'm saving it for Monday because it does require a full reading series. But like, I just want to say that like Stanford mother boy, whose parents are like Peter Baker of the New York Times and what's her name, Susan Glasser, like two of the biggest journalists in the world. The fulsome, if my father ever talked about work I did with the same level of fulsome praise that Peter Baker did, I would die from humiliation. I would crawl under the universe to die.
Yeah, especially when it's like the article is basically like, I'm friends with some kids at school, but not the others. It's not even like campaign trail or anything. It's just bullshit. If I wrote an article like that, my family would sell me.
You know, some of the kids at my school know who Peter Baker is, and so they pretend to like me. And yeah, others don't, and so they don't. And that's a real problem.
And like, yeah, his dad was just like, this story is what Bren Bradley of the Washington Post calls a holy shit moment. Whip smart, and then like a stunning conclusion that leaves you speechless. And like, the conclusion of the piece is like, a college, an environment that's supposed to educate you, is now not educating you. That's basically the tone of the article.
You can hear the whip crack.
Just yeah. Whoosh. All right, that's just get that out of the way. That's just, you know, like you'll have to wait on the Stanford article till Monday. But let's get into it with Michael Judge and Poppy here.
How can anyone with such impressive credentials, who served his country for so long, have achieved such widespread anonymity?
By not playing to the cameras. In the last days of the Nixon presidency, by not taking a cheap shot, by saying, look, he should be treated fairly, and then saying the party should not be dragged into the ugliness, by not going when I was at CIA and calling you up and telling you of all the fantastic changes I made, I know you did, and I'd been better known, but I made changes, I did it quietly, I reported openly to Congress, and then I elevated the morale of the CIA by making them understand that I knew that an intelligence service cannot be effective if you're not going to protect sources and methods of intelligence. So I haven't played for the crowd. I haven't been up against the left field fence jumping up there and catching that, you know, extravagant one. But I hadn't needed that. That's not what I've been trying to do.
But what you do need
is... to do a job and do it well, and I've done it.
This series has been on the back burner for a while. Last time we did it was when we were in Houston and Dallas as part of our Texas tour. And you'll remember last time on Poppy, we examined sort of like his post-Watergate, the post-Watergate era of Poppy, and because we were in Houston, with a special emphasis on the nexus of Texas banks, the Saudis, and the BCCI. Like, and again, sort of, it is so hard to keep all of this together in one's head, because like the tendrils of like multiple global international criminal conspiracies intertwining in this one guy's life is really hard to fit all together. But I want to talk about like when he was appointed director of the CIA. Now, Michael, to set the stage for this, and this is something we talked about a little bit in the series, by like the mid-1970s, the CIA found itself in a bit of hot water, or probably for the first and only time in its existence, it faced some level of democratic scrutiny and oversight. So could you like just sort of set the stage for like what they were facing in the mid-70s and why George H.W. Bush was like the perfect candidate to at least appear like a reformer or like a civil servant who's outside of the agency?
Sure. So, you know, if you take the official word on Bush's term as CIA director, what you're basically going to be told, for the reasons I'm about to explain, is that he was a placeholder. He maybe even cleaned house a little bit. He was just kind of there to shepherd the agency through to the next real presidency, because Ford wasn't kind of a real president. And I think a lot of people just accept that on face value. And yet the CIA headquarters that was built in 1961, it didn't officially have a name for decades. That's where Langley comes from, just as a metonym for the place it is. And in 1999, they renamed it the George Bush Center for Intelligence. So the idea that they would make
a director who only served for like what, basically a year and a half, 2 years. How long was his tenure?
I think it was actually less than a year. I think it was like 350 days or something. And Bush, he manages to find himself in this position. Well, I say manages to find himself. He worked like a fucking demon to find himself in this position, because as you say, in the mid-1970s, the CIA was in as close as the CIA can get to being in trouble in a public sense. And I personally would say that the CIA was probably most in trouble when they decided to kill the president. That was kind of like...
That was a yikes moment for yeah, them. Yeah.
They were feeling the heat on that one. But the mid-70s were a big period for revelation of what the fuck it is that the CIA actually does, because it's kind of hard to imagine now, but in the first 25-ish years of its operation, I think people generally thought it is what it says it is. It collects intelligence on stuff and then gives it to people who do something about it. And there is a growing awareness that this is not the case. So in 1974, they attempt what you would call a limited hangout called the Rockefeller Commission, which is basically a way for them to mention some bad stuff the CIA has done and then go, but of course we never do any of that anymore. We would never do that. And I believe the heart attack gun, which is real, actually comes from the Rockefeller Commission.
Does it work though?
I mean, look, Stanley Cooper, I don't know what the range on it is, but it might. And the Rockefeller Commission is considered, I mean, as it was designed to be, basically this kind of self-exculpating, like, oh, no, we're fine now, though, affair. And so there is further inquiry demanded. And the two most important ones were called the Church Committee and the House Select Committee on Assassinations. Church Committee run by Senator Frank Church, who probably should have been the Democratic nominee in 76, and House Select Committee on Assassinations directly afterward. And you can see that we're going from committees that are named after guys to committees that just say assassination in the name.
Because what's this committee about? What are we here to talk about again? Yeah. Church?
Yeah.
No, all the assassinations the CIA did.
Yeah, so people from even just 74 to 76 or so have suddenly been hit with this deluge of information about what the CIA actually is, which is to say, and I want to put this uncontroversially, The American SS of the Fourth Reich, I think would be fair.
You know, this is an independent podcast, Michael. You don't need to, like, you know, shade or dumb down what you really think.
This was a really interesting time culturally, too, because if you look at a lot of, like, very popular movies and even, like, TV around this time, there was a lot of stuff where the villain is explicitly or Romana Clef of the CIA.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, believe it or not, it actually used to kind of be a bad career ending thing when a journalist was caught openly working with American intelligence around this time. Again, you know, you very aptly call it the closest the CIA has ever gotten to being in trouble. And, you know, it's such a low bar, all of this stuff, but it's unimaginable now, kind of.
And, like, speaking of the cultural turn, it just makes me think of the 1975 movie 3 Days of the Condor, which was like, and guess what? Richard Helms was the technical advisor on that film. Him and Robert Redford became very pally on the set of that movie.
That's really interesting.
What do you make of Richard Helms being the official advisor to a movie about how the CIA does assassinations on American soil?
That, I think, is a particularly interesting example because, you know, we know the CIA and the culture industry go way back, Operation Mockingbird, all that kind of thing. And as Felix says, there starts to be this spate of books, movies, whatever, where the CIA is openly depicted as basically a monstrosity. And so I think the CIA realized very quickly, we got to fight back. We have to make some cultural products about how there are a few bad apples in the CIA. And you remember in 3 Days of the Condor, Robert Redford is in the CIA too.
Yeah.
He's just one of the good ones. So we have to give people the impression that, yes, we were this absolute fucking atrocity factory for 25 years. But now we're just guys who read books. And the appointment of Poppy Bush as director under Gerald Ford goes perfectly right along with that.
And, like, this is something we talked about in the part one and two of Poppy, is this idea that he was serving as ambassador to China at the time and, like, conspicuously was out of the country when all of these committees were happening.
Yeah.
And then, like, as like, you know, to sort of get the heat off going into the Carter election, they bring in George H.W. Bush. They call him back from Shanghai to clean house as a, like, an outsider to the agency and a civil servant who has zero ties to the intelligence community. And, you know, listen to our first couple episodes, but yeah, like, you know, Zapata Oil, all of that stuff. Like, I mean, yeah. So George Bush comes back from China and is appointed CIA director with a mandate to kind of, like, clean house of all of the shady stuff that's been going on. But really, this was about closing ranks and making sure something like this, like the Church Committee, never happened again.
Absolutely. You know, they say, yeah, career civil servant, nonpartisan. You played on one of your episodes that amazing clip of him saying, there's no political mileage in a job like this. Good heavens. and of course, Poppy is not only directly connected to the CIA back to at least 1953 and the Zapata Oil stuff, but there is a deeper connection here in that I think to some extent he did his kind of cleaning house, which was not at all the popular image of it, because he wasn't just working with the CIA. He was the scion of the exact CIA milieu. You know, the people he grew up around, the adults, Prescott Bush, Alan John Foster Dulles, Averill Harriman, these are the basically the Nazi sympathizing Wall Street lawyers who started the CIA. And so there is an odd sort of house cleaning in that he is trying to take this back for the white collar macro managers rather than the freaks like David Ferry and Guy Bannister, who, you know, inevitably end up like they're in the drunk tank for a night, and then to try to get out, they yell that they killed John Kennedy. Like, we're not going to have people like that anymore.
Yeah, you can't have these Southern dandies and weirdos, causing problems when you kill the president. And then, like, I think the interesting thing that comes out in a lot of your work is how integral the, like, in terms of like reforming the CIA away from these weirdos and into a professional corporate, you know, white shoe law firm Nazis, is the use of computer networks and data organization and analysis, which does dovetail with the promise software that we talked about in the Octopus Murders episode. But before we get into that, I just want to like just go back to, like, this idea of like when he's appointed to the CIA. Gerald Ford is the one who appointed him. Now, you also mentioned that Gerald Ford, I mean, you mentioned to me that Gerald Ford was on the Warren Commission. So it's unlikely that Gerald Ford, despite being something of a dunce, would be unaware of Poppy's intelligence connections.
Yeah, there's an interesting double game these guys may be playing, in which, you know, it's all supposed to be about cleaning up. But Gerald Ford, as you say, on the Warren Commission. In fact, there is an incredible piece of footage from, I believe it's Gerald Ford's funeral, where Poppy Bush is giving the eulogy. And right as he says, you know, when President Kennedy was tragically slain by a lone gunman.
After a deluded gunman assassinated President Kennedy, our nation turned to Gerald Ford and a select handful of others.
He fucking grins right at people in the front row. So I think he and Ford had something of an understanding. And the other note about this is that when Poppy comes in, his I don't remember what his particular specific rank was at this point, but the guy he brings in to be his number two is Ted Shackley, who is.
Could you explain a little bit about who Ted Shackley is?
Yeah, Ted Shackley, the CIA
number one money getter.
Absolutely. It, because the CIA started with like Yale poetry students. They love giving each other moronic nicknames. So Ted Shackley was called the Blonde Ghost. And
if you remember back, Poppy's nickname from Yale was Mammon.
Yeah, yes. Oh, we got another great Poppy nickname coming later for Gladio shit. Shackley was like the archetypal spook. He was the guy who was running the JM Wave anti-Castro shit. In Miami, after Kennedy had specifically told them to stop and they didn't, he was arguably, you know, there's some contention over this, but he may have been the man single most in charge of the Phoenix program in Vietnam, in which we tortured, imprisoned, and slaughtered about 200,000 innocent people. And Shackley, I think, was quite clearly meant to be Poppy's successor. But then Jimmy Carter comes in. And Jimmy Carter, whatever his manifold other problems, at least sees something here and goes, yeah, I don't think I want Ted Shackley to be the next guy, and replaces him with a semi-outsider, Stansfield Turner.
He was an admiral in the Navy, right? He wasn't this guy, yeah.
So then we've got this gap, Carter to 1980, right? And Shackley was one of the main campaign advisors on Poppy's presidential campaign, until it was obvious that Reagan was going to win. And I think it's very likely that if Poppy had won, Shackley would have been made CIA director. So the idea that this is cleaning house, no, it's not cleaning house at all. It's just restoring continuity to a certain vision of the CIA and then expanding it beyond anything anyone can imagine.
And like, what was that vision? If you had to describe, like, what was the vision that these men had and were trying to, like, recreate or assert in their role at, like, the center of the U.S. national security state?
This is a part where technology comes into it hard. And just to sort of give a little background of what kind of technology we're talking about, we look back at the Vietnam War, right? And it's considered a failure in military terms. It was also a huge deep state laboratory for them to test and get away with shit. They had no other place to test. And the Phoenix program, and then part of the Phoenix program, which was called Operation Igloo White, were essentially the first live in the field proof that massive computer networks could be used in real time in a war. And Phoenix in particular ends up becoming the basis for most subsequent American police departments.
Daryl Gates has a connection to all of this. The guy who created the SWAT team and, you know, was like most associated with like the violent racism of the LAPD in the late 80s and 90s.
Yeah, he was the image of the violent police chief in a major American city, and for good reason. He once said, about chokeholds that black people's arteries don't open as fast as they do in normal people. So you have to choke them differently. Well, Daryl Gates was also very likely a CIA asset. And the entire time he was the head of the LAPD, he had at least a weekly meeting with the CIA advisor. So given both the techniques and the technological structures we see being imported back to the U.S., it seems almost certain that the CIA was at least in part suggesting the direction of the LAPD during this period. And, you know, who knows how many other major police departments, certainly the Chicago PD.
And also, like, during the same time period, what is domestic law enforcement? What's their new remit? It's to fight the war on drugs. Because holy shit, exactly. All of a sudden, Southern California is flooded with cocaine.
Yeah, it's they are now an occupying army, thanks in a huge part to the heroin that the CIA is now bringing back from Southeast Asia, because they've gotten rid of the French Connection or just doing it themselves. And then, of course, that evolves into cocaine and all the Iran-Contra stuff. So basically, you have this sudden massive scale adoption of computer network systems in the mid 70s, which means the birth of an enormous new amount of complexity. Because something that at one point, say, a CIA operation, and when I say operation, I don't mean like a big thing, just, you know, one note, someone did this, this guy met that guy and he said that. You know, that would have been on a handwritten memo not very long before this. Now it is producing enormous amounts of data as it goes through all these network systems. Every step produces more and more data, more and more documentation, more and more specialized documentation, which, of course, is a big part of it that most people don't know how to read or interpret any of this shit. So all of a sudden, everywhere we've got records, databases, files, hard drives, just fucking stuff. And this is pre-promise as well. So though the idea of searchable information to us is like the most obvious thing in the world, that of course you have to have a search engine, that shit didn't exist yet. The massive searchable database didn't exist. So unless you knew exactly what you were looking for, it was really hard to find anything. And I think Poppy's part of his vision in reorganizing the CIA along its original lines was to incorporate this massive technical complexity, because it was almost impossible with all that data to pinpoint who exactly did what exactly anywhere exactly. And he realized, and this is something Felix has talked a lot about on the show, and something I think is we are still deeply living with the consequences of, that instead of trying to run these siloed off little operations where inevitably someone talks or gets killed, whatever, hide in plain sight, hide in the sudden fucking wilderness of information that is now being produced about everything. There's that famous Angleton phrase, the wilderness of mirrors, about basically losing the distinction between paranoid ideas you have and the actual world. And this is a kind of inverse wilderness of mirrors, where now anyone looking to try to figure these things out,
they create that same hall of mirrors. They create that, exactly. That infinite regression of mirrors for anyone who attempts to like understand this or like, you know, or gather the information that could render an objective judgment on the historical record.
Right. You're just drowned.
It's interesting what you said about Vietnam being a testing ground for all these things they couldn't test anywhere else, because in a lot of cases, like through trial and error, they did end up developing like highly effective things. Like the modern efficacy of like American style special forces was pretty much born out of like long range patrols, mm-hmm. from the American side in Vietnam. Like things like American air superiority, that was born out of like smaller and more agile MiGs like tearing up F-4s before they had beyond visual range missiles. But it was also like Vietnam was like the last instance of a lot of things. It was sort of the death of a World War II national security state. And one of those things was sort of restricting information via suffocation and censorship, as opposed to deluge. The next war, you know, the next like big war, the Gulf War, the one overseen by Poppy, was a perfect example of that maturation. Instead of
it was on CNN, you just
incredibly restrictive, right? Instead of like an incredibly restrictive information environment, you were just flooded with it.
Yeah, and we are. I mean, it's a sort of a pet theory of mine that World War III already happened, and it's everything that happened from the moment World War II ended until the moment the Soviet Union ended. All of that supposedly saving the third world from communism was World War III. So after Vietnam,
I think that's a very good way of thinking about it.
So after Vietnam and then up to the Gulf War, we're at war that entire time too. It's just being done by more secretive means, by more vastly illegal means, by more vastly complex means. And there is a connection to this later involving Bush and what has become the foregrounding of special operations in the American military too, because he wasn't interested in most cases in, you know, boots on the ground. He wanted as few people as possible, all running discrete little networks. And ideally they wouldn't know anything more about each other than they had to. And I think this is kind of Bush's vision of himself, not just as CIA director, because of course that's only a year, but as the like the fucking dark archon of the deep state for the next 50 years, is I control the network of networks. I control the structure of structures. It's not me giving orders and people doing it. It's that I have a hand in every conceivable, meaningful, important network, from, you know, drugs to guns to human trafficking. And I make these networks interact in such a way that they're following their own ostensible self-interest, right? But their self-interest is also my self-interest. And they don't necessarily know that they're working for me. And so much the better if they have no idea that they're working for me.
Yeah, if you look at, like, you know, what special forces specifically became, what's incredible is their open mission statement. A lot of what they do, the bulk of what they do when they're actually deployed to combat zones, is just micro gladios.
Exactly.
They call it force multipliers, but it's exactly what you said. It's creating a system of systems of, like, you know, counterinsurgency or insurgencies that all answer to, you know, a group of a few dozen guys that answer to one guy.
Yeah. I mean, this is what Gladio was in a larger sense, you know, that I'm sure some listeners will know this, but most CIA NATO Gladio operations in Italy were run out of what was ostensibly a Masonic lodge called P2, Propaganda Due. And the head of Propaganda Due was a guy named Licio Geli, who had been an Italian SS officer. And along with all the million other things they did, most famously the Roberto Calvi murder, which sort of blew the whole thing open, Licio Geli has said that he considered Poppy Bush to be a member of the P2 Lodge. And in order to avoid putting his name on anything, Geli named him La Rosa Bianca, the White Rose.
I mean, the guy's got a building, got the CIA building named after him, and getting fruity Italian nicknames. Like, this is not just a guy who served in the CIA for like a half a year and then went off to become president after, you know, doing his job. This is a guy, yeah, who's been in the agency since the 50s, as you said. But Michael, I want to go back to this idea about Vietnam as a proving ground and the Phoenix program and its use of, like, a development of, like, real-time data collection in war zones and how that can be used to create basically hit lists. I mean, after October 7th, I remember reading a story about how Israel basically has turned over their drone assassinations to, like, an algorithm that just, like, algorithmically and then exponentially selects targets for termination. So it's like now there's not even a human being who's like saying, kill this person, kill that person. It's just a human being who's looking at a computer screen that's telling them who needs to be hit.
Right.
So how does that grow out of something like the Phoenix assassination program and these computer networks as they began to be developed in the late 70s and 80s?
So the computer networks that we see in things like Igloo White during the Phoenix program, they were used to, and it's hard to get people to describe these things in great detail because the people who were there seeing it didn't know a lot about computers. And the people who know a lot about computers are not going to talk to you. But essentially, it would seem that the major goal of that operation was to provide a real-time map of the Ho Chi Minh Trail to see what was going on, who was moving through, not just people, vehicles, material, whatever else. And of course, like you say about the modern drone program, they were essentially seeing dots on a screen and going like, well, that fucking could be Viet Cong. You don't know that it's not Viet Cong. And so in terms of like actually providing for the Phoenix program intelligence targets who would be useful assets or whatever, it was pretty much completely fucking useless. But the fact that they could map something real world in real time electronically, see where people were going, see to a certain extent what people were doing. And then as that era of, sort of deep state technology moves on into the promise era, we get this massive expansion because suddenly instead of all this raw data where it's just, some code word for a fucking bogey on the map and, sets of coordinates and, time, PM, AM, whatever, you now have all that stuff in a searchable database. And H.W. Bush is deeply plugged into the entire promise thing. And so we moved from just sort of blanket data collection to the ability to find patterns in data collection. That's why the promise thing was so fucking huge that it's almost hard to understand because it seems so primitive now. But the idea that you could just you throw in anything you want and then search and it'll find a pattern of, this guy has been at this place this many times in the last year. There's an example somebody gave, somebody who was selling promise, Ari Ben Manasha or somebody like that, saying, you take a look at this guy and he's not paying power or water bills all of a sudden for 2 weeks, no power or water. And then you see another guy that you think he knows and that guy's power and water bills suddenly go way up. And so you can perhaps infer from this, first guy is at the second guy's place. Now, the perhaps infer is the big part because they don't act like these are tendentious inferences. They act like they're the truth. And the story of something as now totally taken for granted as Barack Obama's decision to follow in W. Bush's footsteps and just decree that the president of the United States can kill anyone on earth at any time for no reason. You look at the data collection on that shit and it is astonishingly shoddy and half-assed. And there have been more than a few cases where we were outsourcing data collection to people like Saudi Arabia, for instance. And the Saudis yeah. would give us a target and tell, oh yeah, it's that guy. It's number 5 on the terror list, whatever. And we would blast him off the face of the earth. And then it would have turned out to be a completely different person. It was just someone the Saudis didn't like. And they were like, oh man, sorry.
That's like 98% of what we did in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
Just like it, just going up to some guy and being like, okay, who's Taliban? And he just tells you it's his neighbor who he hasn't liked for 20 years.
Absolutely.
And also pedophilia is incorporated somewhere along in those steps.
I mean, it often is. There's more than a little bit of that around promise too.
Yeah, it goes kind of like peanut butter and chocolate. And Michael, I guess like I what's ringing in my ear is as we go through this is the New York Times op-ed video that I made fun of a couple days ago about how the deep state, they're just like us. They listen to Taylor Swift. They're just basically career civil servants who work in things like, you know, healthcare and NASA. But they're no, like that's not the people we're talking about are like a different breed than like a guy who works at the Department of Labor.
Yeah, the deep state is these unelected motherfuckers who somehow every change we supposedly go through, every political shift that supposedly happens in this country, you look far enough and somehow they're not only in every administration, but they're getting more and more powerful. Despite the fact that, oh, we're swinging left or whatever.
Didn't Biden just appoint Elliot Abrams to some fucking post?
Yeah, Elliot Abrams is back.
Elliot
in the federal
fucking
government.
Abrams, Mr. Chainsaw himself.
Dog. I know we talked about that video, yeah. But it's just so fucking insulting. Yeah, that's who I'm talking. I'm not talking about like a group of people who have more bodies than big tobacco. What I actually mean is like the guy who put stickers on pork chops.
yeah,
those are the same thing. Yeah.
This is Radhika Fox.
I am the Assistant Administrator for Water at the Environmental Protection Agency.
She loves Pilates, making salads, and watching the Taylor Swift Eras Tour on TV with her family.
I think we're all pretty 1989.
Yeah, and it's this question about technology and the technological complication of mass data, too, highlights another very important element of Bush's tenure as head of the CIA, which was privatization. He was the prophet of privatization of what, you know, at first we would call intelligence functions and now has gotten up to, you know, I mean, essentially everything. I don't know if there's any part of the U.S. armed forces that isn't partly privatized. And it was Bush getting rid of the guys in the CIA. There was a certain kind of guy that he was known to call a knuckle dragger. And these were guys like William King Harvey, the drunk who famously accidentally threw his gun across the bathroom because he had to take a shit so bad.
Wait, he was just like, he was dying for one. He was trying to get his pants up and he was like, oh, get it out of here.
He ripped his pants down so hard that his gun went under the door and just flew across the bathroom.
These are the cavemen who George Bush famously made fun of were these the guys who wanted to quote unleash Chiang Kai-shek? They wanted to unleash Chiang.
No, that was him making fun of Birchers. That was like a Bircher thing, which of course Jeb Bush interpreted as no, he actually really wanted to unleash Chiang Kai-shek.
And a lot of crossover.
He would say, "I'm going to unleash Chiang" before he did his tennis serves, which I always thought was very funny.
It's interesting that you bring up the Birchers, Felix, because this is guys like William King Harvey, guys like, you know, Frank Sturgis, that type of scumbag, had a lot of crossover with the Birchers, with that general political world. And Bush considered them all basically fucking idiots who, even if they could be useful, they're rubes.
Yeah.
Even if they could be useful to do something, they're so goddamn bad at hiding what they do. And
they can't stop talking about it, you know? Like you said, like he's creating a world in which the CIA can exert its influence through like finance, drug cartels, just like an endless network of intermediaries. And if like these John Birch guys had their way, their global war on communism, they just would have been telling you everything they're doing.
It's like a bunch of alcoholic Mormons who like got arrested for pandering constantly. And like guys who like think they're like the comedian from Watchmen, but somehow shittier.
Yeah, there's a great line in Libra, the DeLillo novel, where Guy Bannister is reading a John Birch pamphlet, and it says he reads that there are 500,000 Red Chinese Army massing in Baja California. he knows it is not true. He believes it. Same kind of, I know it's not, but it's how the world feels to me. And getting rid of these guys, because so many of them were, you know, career agency types, goes right along with the privatization of as much of the agency's work as possible, because first of all, there is no civilian way to subpoena any of that shit. If it's the CIA going through a front, through a front, through a front, and then you have BCCI is a perfect example. You know, the American federal government doesn't have any legal right to get all the records of BCCI. So all of this shit is hidden echelon after echelon of secrecy. And of course, if you privatize things, you can make money off of them apart from, you know, your job at the agency. And probably the kind of emblematic instance of this in this period would be the Safari Club, of which Bush was, of course, a member, at which he gave speeches. And this was a relic of the, you know, Church Committee, House Select Committee period, where essentially a bunch of the sort of Bushite CIA people were complaining, you know, we can't do fucking anything. These regulators are all up our ass. So Adnan Khashoggi, who is possibly the biggest arms dealer of all time, and who did most of it on behalf of the CIA, and who also employed Jeffrey Epstein in one of his first major jobs, Adnan Khashoggi bought a literal safari club in Kenya for all these guys to go meet at to do the intelligence shit that they were under too much scrutiny to do in their own countries. There was the French head of intelligence, Alexandre de Maronche, was there. Khashoggi, of course, was there. Saddam Hussein was there when we were friends with him.
That must have been such a cool club to hang out at, like the heyday, you know.
hanging out with like Saddam, Khashoggi, and the Shah of Iran.
You're putting out Cuban cigars on like a rhino's head or something like that. Yeah.
That was probably a live rhino.
You're putting out in its eye.
It was probably like Diddy's all white parties, but without getting molested by Diddy.
Yeah, it was given the interest involved, it was Diddy's white enough parties.
But Michael, so like George Bush, he is not allowed to continue his tenure as director of the CIA when Carter becomes, and he feels sort of like betrayed by that. He's like, what? I thought this was just a continuance of, you know, like a nonpartisan government agency that simply collects the best intelligence and gives it to the policymakers. But then like he's vice president for 8 years when Reagan is president. And like during that, okay, so like leaving in his wake, a kind of like, as you said, like a sort of modernized CIA in which there is no longer any kind of smoke-filled room where any discrete individuals are directing conspiracies or making plans and like sort of like wielding power in some sort of secret. I mean, they are doing that. But as you said, it is just now diffused through this like network of like a million double blinds in which like power is exerted in a way that seems like they're like an organic expression of people's natural instincts and abilities. Yeah. Right. So like, but then like you talk about becoming the manager of like the system of systems and these interactions of all these different networks of like drugs, money laundering, guns, which brings us to what's known as the Iran-Contra affair, which is really like, it's a catch-all term that describes like almost a decade of rampant criminality. Like how would you describe the Iran-Contra affair and George H.W. Bush's role in it?
Man, it is so fucking hard to encapsulate, but partly because he was at one point a director of the CIA and then at one point a presidential candidate and went one point the vice president. But the people he had around him, his disciples, they never abandoned him. It's not like he was suddenly working with all new people, you know, the same way that after JFK fired Alan Dulles, CIA people would go to Dulles's house to ask for directions. Basically, they didn't want to talk to John McCone. Who the fuck is that? You know, this is our chief. In the same way, Bush keeps himself surrounded by his guys from the CIA. So Shackley is one of his closest advisors. So when he was vice president, his chief of staff, almost all of his advisors were CIA people before that. So he is, I would argue, the prime orchestrator of Iran-Contra, and trying to understand everything that happened in Iran-Contra is basically impossible. It should be one of the biggest scandals in American history. And it's not, because almost no one understands what it was. And the name, I think, is very intentionally reductive. Iran-Contra, that, oh yeah, we sold arms for hostages And also we were arming the Contras in Nicaragua. And people think that's it.
Which on its face is pretty bad.
Yeah, it is very bad. But those were just the two most explicit sort of emergences of this network that had been at work now for 15, 20 years, that had its hand in fucking everything. That Peter Dale Scott uses a term I like a lot called meta group, where it's sort of the same idea as the system of systems. Or in relation to Danny Casolaro and the octopus, I've been kind of thinking of it as the headless octopus. It's all just tentacles. It's a billion tentacles all wrapped together.
Yeah, they never link up in any coherent way.
And so this meta group of people involved in Iran-Contra, of, you know, murderers, bagmen, money launderers, above board financial operators, real estate developers, politicians, private pilots, military officers. It's interlinked with like every state level crime of that entire period. And the narrow frame, even within the narrow frame of just Iran and Contra, it would be a life's work to understand just the part of Iran-Contra that happened in Arkansas. Because Arkansas was the cocaine capital of the United States. There's some very interesting stuff about why maybe Poppy and Clinton got along so well after Clinton was elected, that they'd actually been working together secretly for a while. I once played a gig at a bar in Arkansas in like 2008, and a guy came up to me after the gig and put his hand out like for a high five and then slap my hand and walk away. And I realized there's something in my hand. I thought he like put a sticker on my hand or something. And I looked at it. It was just a bag of Coke. He just gave me a bag
of Coke.
You're
just giving it away like that?
Yeah, dude, there is so much fucking cocaine in Little Rock.
Yeah.
And the stories about these
little rocks.
Yeah, absolutely. These, you know, pseudo independent, but also CIA backed paramilitary groups in Arkansas and Kentucky. I mean, that is beyond one person's understanding. It would be beyond any one person's understanding just to understand BCCI. And we mentioned that.
Yeah, I've tried to explain it during a live show in Houston, and I don't know how successful I was, but yeah, it's quite a mouthful.
Yeah, since we mentioned it a few times, BCCI is short for the Bank of Credit and Commerce International. And it was formed in 1972 by this guy named Aga Hassan Abedi, and he formed it.
Oh, I do his stream.
Hell yeah. He was Pakistani, and he formed it such that it really operated out of Pakistan most of the time, but it was incorporated in such a way that no nation had jurisdiction over it, because like every division of it was incorporated in a different country.
that's smart.
Yeah, and BCCI was basically the U.S. and especially CIA bank to do evil shit from the mid-70s to 1992, when it fell apart. It's everything involving Iran-Contra. There's BCCI money in there. Everything with arms deals. Everything with fucking cocaine, heroin. Everything with people who are kind of stringers. You know, Adnan Khashoggi and Manuher Gorbanifar and Ari bin Manasha, Robert Maxwell. You know, all that shit is going through BCCI. And it is hugely involved in the entire Promise thing. And I know you guys just talked about this to some extent, but basically Promise being a sort of early searchable database software that we sold with a backdoor in it to as many other countries as we could to spy on them. Promise, the people doing the Promise sales are the same people doing the Iran-Contra gun sales, are the same people trafficking the fucking coke. Jeffrey Epstein laundered Iran-Contra money working for Robert Maxwell and Ari bin Manasseh years and years before supposedly anyone knew who he was. You know, the entire Rex 84 continuity of government program that goes to 9/11, that's in there too. It's all in there.
I mean, it's like if you're like, you know, like blind men trying to describe an elephant, you know, one guy has the trunk, the other guy has the leg, the other guy's pulling on the big ear, and they all have like a different description of what they're holding on to. But like, it seems like what we're left with here is like a basically like a massive form of like international secret government and crime that like, yeah. you know, raise that, that like funds itself through selling drugs and weapons and then launders the money. And then like, it's just basically like the maintenance of these invisible networks that form like the real structure of power of like the capitalist imperial empire, basically. I mean, that's what I'm feeling trying to describe this elephant.
Yeah. That I would say is pretty much exactly right. And you guys probably know all the stuff from Sybil Edmonds, the former FBI interpreter, who she's a weird person, right? But referring to our dealings with the Mujahideen right up until September 11th as Gladio B, right? I mean, if that's true, they're not even really trying, just calling it Gladio B. And I, ever since this shit has really kicked off in Ukraine, I have been thinking of it as Gladio C. This is the next great guns and money vortex. You know, whenever we need lawyers, guns, and money anywhere else on Earth, but we don't want
the fan.
Exactly. And we don't want people to know that that's us doing it. Ukraine, man, that's going to be the way to go through. And I think the octopus stuff and Danny Casolaro is a really sad example of what this does to people, because here's this guy who he spent, you know, the latter part of his life discovering all this heinous shit, just literally thousands of crimes, and any number of them could have been a giant story unto itself. You know, Wackenhut and the CIA making biological weapons on an Indian reservation in California. You know, you'd think that would be a story.
Yeah.
But Danny is looking for the head, you know, that he's the guy who comes up with octopus. Danny is looking for that smoke filled room where it's like, oh, eight people control all of this. You know, he was continuously subbing in and out who those eight people were in his drafts for the book he was going to write. And Poppy Bush got rid of the smoky room. The coherent principle here is not eight people manipulating history. It's global capitalism. And Danny Casolaro was a sort of a weird American quasi-libertarian who had some links to like Lyndon LaRouche people and shit. So he was not prepared to recognize, oh, it's not that, you know, Edwin P. Wilson has been at every meeting that's ever happened. It's that it's all these evil motherfuckers working in their own interest, which happens to serve the interest of the greater fucking monster.
Let me read you something that John Connolly's been saying about you. In reference to those jobs you held, many of them appointed jobs, he points out now
when you say it.
Connolly's quoted as saying, quote, cleaning it up.
Yeah.
George Bush sat on his butt in those jobs. He had those jobs, but he didn't do very much in those jobs.
I will adhere, albeit difficult, to the 11th commandment. Speak ill of no Republican.
But one of the major questions on George Bush is he tough enough to be president?
But is tough being nasty? Or is tough being a leader that people respect? Is toughness shouting and being ugly and trying to stick a knife in somebody? Or is it principle and leadership where you look over your shoulder and people are following? Let somebody else go out. It's not toughness. Toughness, go out there and say something ugly about somebody? I don't think that.
To bring this into like 2024 in the modern context, we started this out talking about sort of like the popular conception that people have in their mind when they hear about the intelligence agencies or the central intelligence agency. And this idea, I remember this going back to the war in Iraq, because like the word intelligence became very much a part of the news. But it was all done in the idea, like whether it was MSNBC or Fox News, intelligence is always talked about like it is just like an objective collation of data. That like this is just like to make the best decisions, you have to be the best informed. And the CIA is just like a group of, you know, thousands and thousands of experts in discrete subjects who can, like, when called upon, marshal this evidence to get to best inform the like the democratic elected officials who make policy. Right. But like intelligence is never, it's never been something that's not political. Like intelligence is a political agenda. Like, I mean,
exactly.
Like how do you conceive of like intelligence, and how do you think people's perceptions of the roles of these intelligence agencies has changed or changed back into what they were, you know, after World War II?
Well, I think with Danny Casolaro kind of as a reference point, because he believes some goofy shit. He thought that, you know, this octopus that he was hunting down, that these guys were all essentially rogue actors, right? The problem's not the CIA. The problem's not our government. It's not capitalism. No, it's eight bad guys. And he was not able to sort of accept that this is what a system incentivizes well-placed people to do. And I think it's interesting and also horrifying to me that the same period we're getting all this networked computer technology integrated into the worlds of intelligence and the military and so forth, we are also going through the first huge wave of the financialization of the American economy, of deindustrialization. And it is becoming at this point, and now it has become, basically the number one American industry. We do two things. We sell Boeing planes that don't work, and we make up convoluted financial instruments that are just barely legal.
But yeah, there's a connection between like the fact that there is no more smoke-filled room with eight individuals deciding, you know, world affairs, because there's no more like there's no more rooms, there's no more stuff, physical right. objects produced in our economy. It's all speculation. It's all this endless hallway of mirrors that never ends.
Yeah, right. And along with all of that comes the kind of 80s, and I would argue continuing sort of Masters of the Universe mythos that, you know, if you want to make it big and be important in America, what you got to do is be really, really good at noticing some loophole in some law that allows you to borrow $100 billion and never pay it back. Not make anything, not do anything for anyone, just change the abstract numbers on a balance sheet somewhere that may not even refer to actual money that any country has ever printed, you know? And yeah. And there is this decorporealization, I guess you could say, of economics in general that goes along with and helps create this sort of cult of the specialist, cult of the genius, cult of the whiz kid. And I think it has been very easy for people like the CIA to incorporate that into sort of their branding. The idea that, oh no, the CIA are just like, hey, you know, a guy who's really, really smart at a really, really obscure recondite thing. He comes to work for us. You know, those are our, I mean, God, do I even have to mention that I am a cisgendered millennial Latina woman
yeah.
who has been diagnosed with generalized
mental
anxiety disorder, mental health issues. I thought that ad was a joke at first. And what made me horribly know that it wasn't a joke was the part of the ad that starts, I've suffered from imposter syndrome before. and I remember thinking,
that's a good asset for a spook to have. Is
yeah.
I think you're real.
Yeah. And when we have an economy that rewards and lauds and, you know, highlights extreme specialization in extreme recondite fields, basically to make value out of nothing.
Sam Bankman-Fried would be a good example of the whiz kid
right.
who made billions and now is in jail for doing nothing, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, exactly. The motherfucker never made anything. He wasn't even good at financial crime.
No, he was terrible. He was terrible at financial crimes.
Yeah, and I think it is this same cult of specialization that emerges around the time of mass technologization through computer networks and financialization of the economy that I think is able to, or is part of why the CIA is able to reconstitute itself as basically a white collar, almost a member of the creative class, you might say. You know, we're actually creatives here because, you know, James Jesus Angleton is the greatest creative of all. He would drink an entire bottle of gin, and then he would ride Kim Philby around a solarium. And then he'd stare at a wall in the dark for 16 hours and make up how the Soviets could be breaking into the CIA, except not via Kim Philby, of course. And then the rest of his life was acting as though the things he made up were true. That's sort of an artist.
I know it's not true, but I believe it.
Exactly.
I think that like that was the point of the show Homeland. To be like, look, you can have BPD and like, dude, this is a BPD type of job.
Yeah, I mean, and when everything is so decorporealized, decarnalized, you know, when the conditions of all your actions are so fucking detached from anything you'll see in the real world, it becomes pretty easy to get a hold of people who might have gone into, say, marketing or PR or sales or whatever, and convince them, hey, the CIA is marketing, it's PR, it's sales. You don't ever have to touch a gun, although we know you want to and you will, but you don't have to. You know, this is a white collar job like any other. And I think if I just wanted to read this little excerpt from something here talking about that, the massive Bush years change in the CIA and the extent to which, though he was only the director for a year, I mean, he never really left. You know, he joined in 53 and left when he died. And there was this incredible piece by Seymour Hersh about 5 years ago. And because it was in the London Review of Books, nobody fucking read it. And it was about how H.W. becoming the vice president, he does not like or trust Ronald Reagan or William Casey for pretty obvious reasons. You know, Reagan's a fucking moron. And Casey was a fucking loudmouth drunk who would tell anyone anything for press. But even more importantly than that, he wasn't of the old school. He wasn't a Benzman. You know, he didn't have the credentials that somebody like Poppy would require. So what Poppy did was get a bunch of his aides together who were all CIA people or ex-CIA people and essentially create proto-JSOC by himself without asking anyone, with no permission of any kind. And this part from the Hearst story is the background on it. And it's comparing Casey to Bush and says, as the intelligence professionals working with the executives saw it, Casey was reckless, uninformed, and said far too much to the press. Bush was different, and he got it. At his direction, a team of military operatives was set up that bypassed the national security establishment, including Casey's CIA, and wasn't answerable to congressional oversight. It was led by Vice Admiral Arthur Moreau, a brilliant Navy officer who would be known to those on the inside as M. He had most recently been involved as Deputy Chief of Naval Operations in developing the U.S.'s new maritime strategy aimed at restricting Soviet freedom of movement. In May 1983, he was promoted to assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General John Vesey, and over the next couple of years, he oversaw a secret team operating in part out of the office of Daniel Murphy, Poppy Bush's chief of staff, which quietly conducted at least 35 covert operations against drug trafficking, terrorism, and most importantly, perceived Soviet expansionism in more than 20 countries, including, got to get the Spanish accent going here, Peru, Honduras, Guatemala, Brazil, Argentina, Libya, Senegal, Chad, Algeria, Tunisia, the Congo, Kenya, Egypt, Yemen, Syria, Hungary, East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, Georgia, and Vietnam. He was just doing that because he was so well ensconced at this point. The transformation of the CIA had gone so well, and he was so essentially untouchable that there was nobody to tell him no. And he had so many layers of sycophants and disciples that if anything ever did hit the fan over Iran-Contra, he'd be insulated from it. You know, the Iran-Contra hearings were so much about fucking Oliver North and whether Ronald Reagan knew it was happening. And I don't think it's coincidental that there was never a trial to ask, hey, how about the guy who was the head of the CIA? Did he maybe know something was happening? Yeah.
Well, Michael, I think that's a good place to leave things here for today's episode. But there you have it. George Poppy Bush, the boss of all bosses, il capo di tutti capo. You know, but yeah, like if in it, Michael, like your podcast, Death is Just Around the Corner. You've done a lot of research and investigation into like a lot of the, you've picked up just like you've gotten a little wet on the tentacles of some of these things. But I think like, you know, like you've got your grip on a tentacle. But like, just I think it is good to sort of conceptualize this as your conception that like there is no head to this octopus. Yeah. It's just tentacles. And if you try to find the head, that way lies, you know, madness, or just like you won't get anywhere, because like this is all designed so that there's never, ever going to be something that like it will feel satisfying or like a concrete resolution to any of this.
Yeah. You got to study where the tentacles wrap around each other. And in that vein, I did want to give a shout out of acknowledgement to a show called Ghost Stories for the End of the World. That's really great. That did a 13-part octopus series. That is one of the goddamnedest things I've ever heard, including an episode on Poppy Bush. And I also wanted to shout out too. I am a recurring, semi-frequent guest on my little brother's show, Judge Movies, which is, I would say, you know, movie mindset is usually pretty upbeat. Like, even if the films are, you know, depressing or whatever, the enjoyment of the movie is upbeat. And I would say Judge Movies is like the tortured gothic Catholic counterpart to movie mindset.
I will definitely have to check out Judge Movies now. It'd be a good contrast, because like 99% of movies I watch, even if they're bad movies, I have a great experience. I like watching movies.
Yeah, this is where me and him get into, like, we're doing an episode some point soon about a couple Lars von Trier movies. And particularly the house that Jack built. Have you seen that?
Oh, excellent. That? Yeah. It was that was not such a good experience watching that movie.
Yeah. I don't really like Lars von Trier, but that movie is fucking incredible. And I fear to imagine where we will go over 90 minutes with that one.
Or if you dip back into the Death is Just Around the Corner archives, you will hear my appearance where we discuss Stanley Kubrick's
Yes.
Eyes Wide Shut. And, you know, was Stanley Kubrick killed with a heart attack gun for making it?
And yes, the movie is about Jeffrey Epstein.
All right. Michael Judge, I want to thank you so much for joining us. That does it for us today. Till next time, everybody. Bye-bye.
I'm a desperate man. Send lawyers, guns, and money. This shit has hit the fan. All right, send lawyers, guns, and money.
What do you think when people make fun of your language? Like, I get the Dickens on Iran, or someone is in deep doo-doo. You see it coming back. What do you think?
I don't mind. You got to be what you are. Generationally, kids, I don't. You have to be what you are in life. You don't have to style it so you're into the latest fad or the latest thing. And I'm not going to change.